Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Somewhere in Vegas here on blogtalkradio.com. I'm Mark the Key. I'm your host. I'm very privileged to have a really packed show today. In about an hour, we're going to be talking to a very popular singer-songwriter who has a new album called Beautiful Sin. And she'll be out coming up at the top of the hour. Sophia Radish will be on with us. But right now we have a very cool filmmaker. He has worked with some of the more popular studios out in on Hollywood. He's going to be out at the Sundance Film Festival. He has his own company, Clever Fox Media, and he's also really into immersive filmmaking, and we'll find out what that is in just a minute. I'd like to welcome Decker Dreyer with us right now. How are you doing, Decker?
Hey, what's up? How are you? I'm good, man. Yeah. I'm good. I'm, you know, just here in L.A., getting ready for the festival, like you said. Lots of stuff that's going into all the prep for what we're doing over there.
Is this your first time going out to Slam Dance?
As a member of the jury, yeah. I'm actually not showing any films this time. This time they have me out there, and you know, we're going to be looking at all kinds of cool interactive projects and streaming projects and different kinds of experimental films and stuff. So this is my first time doing that with them, but they actually were one of the first festivals that I ever showed films in back in like 2002. So it's really, really cool to, you know, come back to it, whatever, 14 years later as a judge. It's really like kind of exciting for me.
Yeah, I mean, I did a film this past summer that I entered into Slam Dance. Sorry to say, it did not make it in, but I mean, I
will have words with people about this. I will have words with people on your behalf.
Well, I've got another project this summer, so hopefully that'll get in next year. But yeah, I mean, it's great to be able to. I was there last year for the first time. I was able just to be there. I was just there as a you know, just as an observer, especially the Slam Dance Festival, because first of all, a lot of publicists were so open with me in terms of talking to their movies about their movies and really kind of you know, getting the word out about what's going on there. And they're really innovative in terms of that as well. I mean, in the microcosm versus what Slam Dance is, I think. The comparison was made that that Slam Dance was what Sundance was 20, 30 years ago, before it got so Hollywood on everybody. And now Slam Dance tends to be the ones that are the new filmmakers that are wanting to be innovators and want to really have a time to be able to break out as well. I mean, what's been your experience just as a filmmaker being at Slam Dance?
As a filmmaker, like years and years and years ago, it was a really inviting festival. It was really, you know, like you said, it was open. Everybody, you know, has a sort of collaborative spirit. I had a short film there. It played in a block right before a really great documentary about the Ramones called End of the Century. If anybody ever is able to check that out on streaming, it's a really cool feature. Still good friends with those filmmakers. But you know, when people make those comparisons, I gotta call you out, man, because you use the Sundance is Hollywood. You use the word Hollywood, and I always take offense to that because I live actually right around Hollywood, and I always laugh. I hear that, because I look out my window and like Hollywood is so unglamorous, or at least it's like so like rock and roll kind of glamorous. It's not really like what you think of as Hollywood polished. Like you look out the window and I'm literally like looking out right now and there's like some like homeless guy in these like sparkly shoes and stuff, and you know, that's what I think of so it's more like an established sort of studio PR kind of polished thing. I love to think of Hollywood as being a little bit rough around the edges and a little bit rock and roll still.
Well, that reminds me of a story. I mean, I had, I think it was last year, I had the guys from L.A. on who do a really great web series about the Los Angeles area. They do a comedy about it. And we're talking about the idea that L.A. does have its own little, you know, bunch of different characteristics in terms of it. I mean, if you travel like 15 or 20 minutes away from Hollywood, you'll be in a different section that's probably completely different from what Hollywood is. Or, you know, you're about maybe 15, 20 minutes away from the beach, and the beach is way different than what Hollywood is. And I mean, it is definitely its own little, you know, it's just an interesting situation where it's not, LA can't be embroiled into one kind of subset. You can't describe LA in at all. So
the town is completely bipolar, and that's good because it attracts everybody else who's bipolar. And you know, so half the time the party is always going on, half the other time you're doing self examination, and out of the middle comes art. So it's a great place to be creative.
Yeah, because I mean, I was listening to Fighter and the Kid podcast today, and they were talking about the idea that, you know, in a lot of the East Coast places, that if they said that you went to a therapist, it wasn't it's not, I don't think anything kosher. It wouldn't be anything that people would kind of get your butt on. But in LA, it's like nothing, you know. So it's like, you go to a therapist. So. That's how LA is, and that gives it somewhat of its charm as well. I mean, even here in Vegas, it's a little bit different too. But anyway, let's get back to what we're talking about. The festival. I mean, it's great to be able to see some of these young filmmakers as well. I mean, what's it mean to you to be a juror and be able to see some of these people that are making their way up in terms of being creative and maybe being the next wave of filmmakers?
I have to find very inventive ways to do them all in a very short period of time. I'm only at the festival between the 22nd of January and I think the 28th, so there's a lot of filmmakers that I have to find a way to kill in that time span. I don't know if it's going to be poison. I don't know if it's going to be... It has to look like an accident, because I certainly don't need the competition. These guys are all way too good, and I just can't have them getting deeper and deeper in the industry. We're having a hard time as it is. It's so cool seeing the young talent. It really is. I wish I could say that they're going to run the entertainment industry in 10 years from now, but I don't really know what the entertainment industry is going to look like, and that's what's really cool about it, is you're seeing all these great people who are experimenting with what your industry could look like in 10 years.
And don't necessarily say young either, because I am in my 30s, and that is late for a filmmaker, by the way. There'll be some really great filmmakers out there as well. But that brings me to that question. It sets me up with a really good question to ask you. I mean, when you started filmmaking, and I when I was in film school, there was I don't think we had the tools that they have now in terms of being able to have digital, to be able to shoot the way that they kind of shoot, and the stylistic way they're shooting as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that, seeing the evolution in your eyes of how entertainment has gone? And obviously this kind of goes into what you've been doing over at Clever Fox. But tell me a little bit about that, the evolution we've seen in terms of filmmaking in your eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was, I guess back in whatever, the 90s or whatever, starting to do work in the industry, it was still all actual film. I mean, it was real filmmaking. With very few exceptions to that, I mean, Quentin Tarantino being one of them, with, all the stuff that he's doing around Hateful Eight and the 70mm and, wanting to shoot on film and all that, that's all kind of gone to the wayside. And I actually, for me, I think it's really, really cool that we have the digital tools, and there's that barrier to entry that's been sort of knocked down. I have to kind of choose my words very carefully in case anybody's listening who's in the, spies from Kodak or something. But I've never been able to shoot film. I haven't. It's nerve-wracking. Like, I tried to be a camera operator. I was working one day on an Adam Sandler film. I think it was The Waterboy, the football one. And what ended up happening was I would have to help the guys who were shooting the film. I would have to load actual big reels of film into these gigantic canisters that kind of clicked into the top of the camera. And, you had to do it all blind. There was like a tent. There was like a tiny little micro tent that you'd stick your hands into, kind of like you were handling uranium in one of those like Manhattan Project movies. And you would like slide your hands into these gloves, into this little tent, and you couldn't see into it. And just by the way that it felt, you had to kind of thread the film threw into the canister and, like, locked it in place. And I was, like, so terrified that I was going to do it wrong and the thing would catch and they'd ruin a take. And it was, like, giving me a heart attack. So, you know, that was never really a viable option for me to go out and shoot my own film. Back in those days, you had your own kind of specialty. And the people that were film loaders and cinematographers who worked specifically with film, you know, that was a very distinct subset of people, aside from, you know, your directors, your writers, your production artists, all those other people, because you had certain skills and, you know, you were, like, attracted more to one thing and you became really, really good at it. And on the one hand, that made for some incredible relationships. You know, if you look back, like, the work of, like, Stanley Kubrick and all these guys who shot these beautiful, beautiful, crazy images, you know, all through the history of the 20th century. But it kind of detached the writer-director type from the process. And really the revolution that I've seen is that now you have this other kind of hyphenate, which is writer-director-DP. There was a film earlier this year that came out in theaters here in Los Angeles called Tangerine, and it was all shot on iPhones. So it's like, you know, everything is just going all crazy in terms of, you know, you having a story, you having a concept, you wanting to put it down into a fixed medium, and you can grab a tool, and in this case it was, you know, the same tool that the guy's using to, like, text his friends, and he goes out and he makes a movie, and now it's theatrically distributed. I don't know if it's got a wide release, but here in Los Angeles, you know, people were watching it on a big screen and going crazy for it. So that's a really interesting evolution that's taken place, removing that that block that was there between the actual acquisition of your film, the cinematography, and the person who wants to tell the story. And that's kind of cool for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing in terms of, you know, where the industry's gone. It's a good thing. It's kind of a good news, bad news situation. I know when I was there last year, I'd asked, and I know a lot of my listeners will be tired of me telling the story. I was at a panel, and we were talking about the idea that how certain things are made and all that as well. I had asked a question about Breaking Bad, if it would have been something that would have made it through. It would have made it in the 90s, and you know they had A&E said no, it wouldn't have because of the numbers of viewers they would need in terms of the 80s and 90s. However, but now that there's so many other forms of distribution out there now, we're seeing that number has lowered for how many viewers you have to be considered at least a success or a moderate success. That, you know, they give the nod for another season or another couple of more episodes. So we're seeing a lot more content out there, and not more distribution channels, but also we're getting a little bit of saturation there.
Yeah, I mean, as far as distribution channels goes, you'd be surprised about what that really translates to. You know, there are distribution channels in terms of more cable networks than ever. There are distribution channels in terms of I can put something on YouTube or Vimeo. There are distribution channels in terms of I can, you know, aggregate my content, you know, to an Amazon and have it, you know, pay per download or whatever. But in terms of being able to mount an independent film, get it into theaters, that opportunity has all but dried up. All the independent cinema chains are kind of gone or on their last legs. There's only a few holdouts in major cities. When you look at people that are actually paying license fees for content outside of the television arena, I mean, you're really, like, down to Netflix. I mean, that's kind of, like, the only game in town. I think that one of the worst things that ever happened was that we transitioned to... Look, I love Netflix. I know people who work at Netflix. I think it's a great service. I have Netflix. I don't even have TV anymore, but I have Netflix. I love my Netflix. But as a filmmaker, it's really, really difficult because back when, you know, you could make a movie and get it into Blockbuster Video or Hollywood Video or any of those other kind of chain stores, you were dealing with a completely different kind of economy. So if you're going to, and I'll just use completely fake numbers here. I'm sorry, I'm getting really inside baseball. I don't know if your listeners are into it or not. But, like, if you go to Netflix, and I'll use a fake number, I'll say $1. let's say that Netflix says, I will pay you $1 for the rights to buy your film for a certain period of time and show it on my streaming channel. Well, back in the old days, which was like not even 10 years ago, you could get a deal with Blockbuster or Best Buy or any of these other, you know, places that sold physical DVDs or rented physical DVDs, and every store would have maybe 4 or 5 copies of your DVD, and they would pay a premium price for the rental. So let's say that, you know, your cut of that might have been $5 per DVD. So now $5 per DVD times whatever, 3 or 4 copies, $15 times 10,000 stores or whatever it is, and you actually have made your money back on your movie. Now you're in a situation where there's more people than ever who are able to tell their stories, which I love, but they aren't able to sell them. So it's an industry where everybody is more talented than ever and everybody is more broke than ever because you just can't get a decent distribution deal. And a big part of that is, you know, also on the consumer. I really have to lay it back to them because there's an expectation that content, whatever it is, you know, film, games, music, should inherently be free. And that's the whole, like, Spotify music model. That's, you know, kind of where people want it to go. That's even to a certain extent how people, like, compartmentalize Netflix in their own brain. They go, well, I pay $9, so whatever. But at the same time, you know, $9 gets you instant access to tens of thousands of movies and television shows. Well, Netflix isn't paying the same as Blockbuster paid for 10,000, you know, things on their shelves. So they're serving many, many, many more people for a fraction of the cost.
Yeah, like you said, it's kind of a curse and a blessing, like you said. So, I mean, there are, it is, I mean, you know, I mean, it is kind of difficult to make, you know, and that gap is starting to be there. I mean, we used to think that there was a gap back in the day where, you know, there were independent films that may make a decent amount versus the Hollywood blockbusters. But I think now more than ever we're seeing that huge gap because we're seeing the Hollywood blockbusters, the Hollywood studios now want something that makes a couple hundred million, so they'll put a lot of money into a franchise or a single movie, and they won't even consider, you know, a lot of times an independent film. And then an independent film that, you know, maybe, you know, will maybe make a little bit of money as well. So, I mean, it is a kind of a diverse kind of situation there. The economy of Hollywood has changed so much in terms of that, in terms of where their focus is and exactly that. So it's interesting to say the least. I mean, it's interesting to be there at Slamdance to hear, and Sundance and Slamdance both, to be able to hear a lot of these speakers talk a little bit about, you know, the industry and how things have changed, what things they need to do to be successful, what to be aware of, what things or trends are going to be as well, which goes into what you're going to be talking about while there as well, immersive filmmaking. Can you tell us a little bit about immersive filmmaking?
Yeah, well, immersive filmmaking, and I prefer that term to virtual reality, because what I do, I don't really consider it to be virtual reality. Immersive filmmaking is a movie that you would experience in a virtual reality headset. So you recently saw that Oculus Rift went on sale to consumers, and Samsung Gear VR, which is like their virtual reality thing for their Galaxy cell phones, that came on the market over Christmas. PlayStation VR is coming out. So all these headsets are coming out on the market. And what I do with Clever Fox is we actually create content. I don't want to say movies because people have an implied length, and, you know, some of these things are a lot shorter than a feature-length motion picture are. But, you know, we, for all intents and purposes, make, you know, television content or movie content for these headsets. And you can actually, for the first time ever, be inside of the movie. You know, we talk about, oh, the IMAX screen is so big, it's like you're almost inside of it. Well, you know, in this one, you actually are inside of it. And it brings its own interesting production challenges. But from a storytelling perspective, it's so cool because it's 3D. It's 360 degrees front, back, side. It's 180 degrees top and bottom, so you can look at your feet. You can look at the ceiling. And you are a fly on the wall as the story is unfolding. Now, how filmmakers use that, everybody has their own sort of different, you know, methodology and their own sort of like artistic statement that they want to make with it. But, you know, for myself, I'm really just more interested in placing somebody in the middle of the scene. I'm not really interested in, making somebody feel like they're an active participant in what they're watching. To me, that's still fascinating, that you can be, you know, completely immersed in the world of the movie as it's unfolding. And that's why I put that, that line between what I do in, quote, virtual reality, because I'm not trying to simulate reality. I'm trying to put you inside of, like, a hyper-reality scripted experience that, you know, you could only watch in a two-dimensional plane before. It's a really interesting challenge.
Yeah, I think there was a movie last year, I think, that I don't know if it's out yet or has come out yet, but it was from first person's perspective on, and I don't remember what it was called, but yeah, I mean, there's that thing going on, but I think sometimes it might be a little bit ahead of time on that thing, but it'd be interesting to see. I mean, you know, almost like being a spectator in a baseball game, to be able to sit in a chair and watch what's going on, look around, see this crowd out there. See the pitcher throw the pitch. I mean, that experience is something that we haven't quite gotten to yet, but I think you're on the verge of getting to. You know, it's like, you know, the sporting event feel, I think, is probably the best. I guess the best analogy, if that is correct.
I could take it even a step further. I mean, I can really spin this and make this cool. So, you know, let's say, all right, sporting event, you're in a seat. Instead of, you know, being in a seat in the bleachers, let's take that seat and let's put you – do you remember that iconic scene in the original Jurassic Park where they're in the Jeeps and the power cuts off and the Tyrannosaur comes out? I mean, you know, I'm not worried about spoiler warning because, I mean, the thing came out when I was like 12. So, you know, the dinosaur comes out and the eye comes down. He's looking in. The rain is going. So – you are, I think there were three people in that car. You're the fourth person. You're actually in the car with them while the movie's unfolding. That, to me, is where this is going as immersive filmmaking, and that's what, like, really excites me. It's a combination, to me, of movie and almost like theme park ride. You have to kind of, like, merge the two in your head and create a new storytelling medium from that.
Do you think that we'll be able to eventually, and I mean, it might give you an idea. I know it's going to be kind of, it's still in the stages like that. I mean, it's obvious, it's a kind of, I won't say 3D-ish, but I mean, have we gotten to that point where, you know, that tipping point where we could probably see immersive filmmaking kind of dive into the 3D aspect where it's a little bit more closer to that reality? I mean, are you close to that?
Yeah, I mean, we actually do film in 3D. And again, I'm going to kind of pull the curtain back a little bit here. To shoot in 3D, my company, Clever Fox, has a camera or a series of cameras. It's actually 18 different cameras, and they're all kind of arranged inside of this this manufactured, you know, sort of housing that allows you to capture 12 images or 12 videos all at the same time in a circle, and then three on the top and three on the bottom. And the reason that you're using so many cameras is because you are actually capturing 3D. So what you can't do yet is you can't get up and walk around inside of the scene. It's all from a single point perspective. And we can move the camera and we can do, you know, all the kind of conventional tricks that you can do in filmmaking. And, you know, they're just that much cooler in virtual reality. There's a film that I'm working on right now where we're doing that sort of like Evil Dead forest flight kind of shot. And, you know, when you're essentially the camera, you are moving through the forest as that. It's really, really cool to experience it. So, you know, we can guide the motion, but we can't give you the freedom to make the motion on your own. That's kind of where we're at technologically. But there are companies out there that are actually trying to get over that hump so that you could get up and walk around inside of a scene. You know, you could be inside of Reservoir Dogs walking around the main characters when they're pointing the guns at each other. You could actually be walking around behind them any way that you want, like maybe 5 years from now. But right now, we are 3D and everything. It's just from a single point of perspective.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's great to be able to see that, like the companies, the cell phone companies, are coming up with these equipment, so you can be able to, and kind of immerse yourself into watching movies or whatever with their headsets. And obviously, this is a great leap for you because you can start doing content in terms of that as well. I mean, it's great. As I think you probably your timing is probably almost perfect in terms of this as well. So hopefully, we'll be able to see if we if any of your content can start reaching some of these new products that just came out around Christmas as well. Is there any projects that are coming up for you in terms of that?
Well, we since this is kind of the infancy, we're doing commercials in virtual reality as well as original content. Like we talked about before, there's sort of that discrepancy between the finances of the industry and where this is all going and how do you monetize it and all that. So part of what I do is at Clutter Fox is we use the commercials that we create to underwrite original content because I feel that nobody's going to be interested in getting these VR headsets and exploring what we're doing and what other great filmmakers are doing if the only thing that's available on there is a whole bunch of commercials. So, we do have to kind of feed the beast, and that means we go and we do the commercial work, but then I specifically, take money out of that and redistribute that into pushing forward and making interesting content that is not, branded or tied to a company message. I think that's incredibly important is to maintain that artistic integrity and, keep innovating in ways that, other companies might not. You have to have that that wall there where it is an artistic vision versus a complete commercial endeavor. So as far as the commercial side goes, we did a piece for Disney recently, and I talked about this. I did the Television Academy's 2015 VR panel, and this was like a big thing for them. Because this Disney project was part of a launch when Facebook started letting you do virtual reality on your timeline. And you can, either watch it in the browser and scroll around in it, or you can hit a button and, watch it in your Oculus or your Google Cardboard or your Samsung or any of those things. And that piece that we did for Disney, which was this really cool sort of commercial done in the style of those old, goofy sportsman instructional video things where Goofy kind of takes you on this haphazard tour of Disney World through a series of accidents. So that got 8 million views in the first, 10 days that it was online. And it was shared 70,000 times. And I think there were something like 8,000 comments and, another 50,000 or 60,000 likes. And, it was just this incredible response to this piece. So people are interested in the medium. Some of our other content that is made specifically for VR headsets that is like independent filmy, we're getting in the range of maybe 30,000 views per month on some of these titles individually, not collectively. And to me, that's also, huge because that is as many people or more than would see an independent film, probably an independent feature-length film, maybe throughout the course of a whole year. There might be only 10,000 or 15,000 people that see a certain independent film, but everything that we're putting out on the headset is getting about, 30,000 people watching it every month. So that's a really cool win for me for a medium that's so incredibly new. And then the success that we have with Disney tells me that it's only going to get bigger and better when more money is being poured into the different platforms and more people are actually able to get out there and experience it when they have a headset at their house.
Yeah, I think that, like I said, your timing's almost absolutely perfect right now to be able to launch something like this. So I'm very interested to see how this kind of goes as well. Like I said, you'll be a jury member on the Slam Dance panel. You'll be doing a fireside chat, talking a little bit more about this immersive filmmaking over there as well, and then all your projects are all there as well. Where can they find you on social media?
You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Dekker, D-E-K-K-E-R, Dreher, D-R-E-Y-E-R. You can find me at DeckerDreher.com. You can find me at CleverFox.media. A lot of our films are on Little Star. That's little without an E, littlestar.com. And if anybody is at the Slam Dance Film Festival, the panel talk is on the 26th at 2:30 p.m. over at the Treasure Mountain Inn. It's going to be me. It's going to have the chief content officer of Little Star. It's going to have Kim Adams from Google Spotlight Storytellers. It's going to have a whole bunch of really cool, innovative VR people from the companies that are really on the cutting edge.
Yeah, I wish I could be up there for it. I'm stuck premiering my little piece actually up in Montana. But hopefully next year I'll have a piece up there for Slam Band. So.
Well, excited, man. And, let me know how it goes in Montana. I'd love to take a look at it.
Oh, no problem at all. And best of luck to you. Well, I mean, let me know. Keep me in touch and let me know how things are going. And if there's any other big projects, we'll have you back on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Take care.
Yeah, thank you, Decker. That was Decker Dreyer, everybody. You guys can check him out at Decker Dreyer, deckerdreyer.com. Also, cleverfox.media. You guys can check him out there as well. Brilliant guy. If you're at the Slam Band Film Festival, please stop and say hi and let him know that you've listened to him on the show. Really appreciated to be able to do that as well. Like I said, I was hoping that I'd be able to get back up to Slam Dance real quick, but my film didn't make it up there, and I'm premiering it elsewhere, so I won't be able to do it this year. But definitely check out if you're in the area, if you're in the Utah area, or just wanted. I mean, last year I just did a quick trip up to Salt Lake City, all the way from Vegas. It's only a couple hour drive, you know, and I find a little cheap hotel room and go to Park City and see, check out some of the movies. It was absolutely really good. The festive atmosphere was absolutely great. Actually the weather was pretty mild last year. I think it's going to be pretty mild this year as well, in terms of Park City as well. So, definitely check that out if you have the interest. You know, we're talking about filmmakers. I decided to pull out an interview I did from 2008, I think it was 7 years ago, I think. I'll have to double check on that. I think it was, 2008. So a little over 7 years ago, I had an interview with Chris Duddy, who did a movie called Cougar Club. Chris was a guy who did a lot of photography before he went to filmmaking. As well, he had another movie coming out. Sorry to say, I didn't get him back on to talk about his other movie during the interview. But Chris has done such a great job in terms of the industry, in terms of being a director of photography as well as a filmmaker himself. So, without further ado, we have this interview from 2008 with a filmmaker, Chris Duddy.
I'd like to welcome, I believe this is Chris. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, this is Chris.
Hey, Chris, how's everything going in the movie biz?
You know, it's good. Things are going.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about Cougar Club. I got to see some of the movie this over the weekend.
Okay.
First of all, I think you were one of the writers of the movie, right?
Yes.
What do you think about the whole cougar culture and how the cougar culture has seemed to be growing in the past 10 years?
I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon, to say the least. I think, you know, I was never the guy that liked the older women, but there's always one guy in your group that's the guy that likes the older women, and we definitely had one of those guys when I was in high school and college. But the difference now is that the older women are taking so much better care of themselves in this new, it's like their sexual revolution. You know, it's interesting that these women grew up in the 60s, you know, early 70s or whatever, and that was the sexual revolution, and they're kind of revisiting a sexual revolution now, like in their 40s, you know? So, 40s and 50s. And, I think it's great. I mean, like I said, I was never that guy, but you know, it's a women empowerment thing, and I think it's about time.
What drove you guys to write a script? Cougar Club.
Well, what happened was, I'll tell you exactly what happened. One of our investment partners had called us one day and said he's from Scottsdale, Arizona, and he called and said, "Hey, have you guys ever seen this website called UrbanCougars.com?" And we went on, you know, went online and checked this UrbanCougars.com out, and you know, we were laughing and like, you know, how great that was. not laughing at it, of course, but you know, and just and then my producing partner and I just looked at each other and said, "God, there's a movie here somewhere. We gotta come up with a movie for this." And we literally that, you know, an hour later we had an outline for a script, and we, my writing partner and I wrote the script.
And you guys have had a great cast in the movie. You have Carrie Fisher, you have Faye Dunaway, Joe Mantegna,
yeah, and
yeah,
Kaylee Cuoco, and
yeah,
a lot of people.
And,
Jolie Fisher did a cameo.
Mo Collins, who's a great comedian. Chyna, of course, the first wrestler.
Yeah, John Polito, who's been in almost all the Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah. So yeah, what's it? I mean, what was it like casting the movie? It seemed like
it was a blast because it was really interesting. A lot of the agencies really responded to the script, and a lot of actresses really. I mean, we met with a lot of, you know, actresses, famous actresses that wanted to be in the movie because of the subject matter, and the fact that we, like some other movies that have been made, make fun of the older women and with the young guy. We actually embraced it and you know, made them sexy and smart, and you know, it was a good woman empowerment thing for them. But at the same time, you know, we there's the funny and the raunch and you know, the cool style of filmmaking for the target audience, which is the, you know, the young guy, the high school college guy.
Hence the kitty scene in the movie. I'm thinking. What was it like working with Carrie and Faye?
Well, Carrie is great. I love her. She's actually my sister-in-law, and I've known her for a long time. So she thought. I mean, she read the script and she called me and she said, "Chris, women are gonna love this movie." And I was like, "Perfect. That's what I wanted to hear." Because I know the guys will like it, because it's got all the, like I said, the good, you know, the good humor in it. So yeah, it was great. And Faye, you know, Faye is a legendary actress, Academy Award winner. But she's, you know, she's getting a little cranky in her older age, you know. But no, it was fine. It was fine. She's a professional, and you know, like I said, she's a legend.
You come from a very interesting background yourself. You came from a cinematography background, a visual effects background, into
yes.
Producing. How did you make that transition?
Well, I studied photography in college, and then my first job was at ILM, which is, you know, Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's visual effects company. That's, you know, the best visual effects company in the world, and I lucked out and got a job there when I was really young, and just kind of fell into the visual effects part. It wasn't really my intention, you know. I really wanted to make my own films, and I did it for a long, long time, and then transitioned from visual effects into cinematography, which is, you know, more of a passion. But again, it still wasn't fulfilling all my needs as a filmmaker and a storyteller and wanting to make my own film. So I started my own company a few years ago to do that. And sort of, I just made the transition happen myself. You can't really, you know, it's really hard if you don't have, you know, family in this business, and I'm first generation in my family in this business. So, I really, I had to make things happen for myself and on my own. So I just, you know, I just didn't take no for an answer and made it happen.
Now, you had kind of a scare there earlier on. I believe you were on an episode of I Shouldn't Be Alive. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, I was filming, doing aerial photography for a movie called Sliver, which is a Sharon Stone, Billy Baldwin movie, and we were in Hawaii filming a sequence over an active volcano on the Big Island, and we had engine failure right over the cone of the volcano. We crashed inside the volcano, and we were trapped in there for a couple of days, and it was a big rescue effort, and it was pretty intense. But we all survived. There were three of us in the helicopter. We all three survived, but it was three different days and three different rescues.
Man.
Yeah.
And were you the first one rescued, or were you the last one rescued?
I was second.
You were second.
I was second. The pilot got out first. I got out. He got out first the first day. I got out the second day. The end of the second day, I just ended up climbing out because there was a lot of rain, weather. The rescuers couldn't get to us. It was a mess on all fronts. And then the third guy, Mike Benson, got out the third day with the helicopter rescue. So it was.
And did you have any scars or anything?
No, I mean, literally, I have a few scars on my arms from just cuts, but we all kind of were injury free. I mean, we had some lung pulmonary damage, you know, initially, just like bronchitis from breathing in all the sulfur and the bad air, but no, it wasn't. Didn't really. I mean, the pilot had stitches over his eye, and that was about it. We got really lucky.
It sounds like it. But you guys got the shot, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. But the film stayed in the volcano, so we never saw the footage, and they ended up trying to recreate it with a miniature, and then test screened it with a test audience, and the ending of the movie tested really poorly, so they rewrote the ending like seven different times, and ended up being a mess because we didn't get to finish the sequence for real photography. So and then, like I said, it tested poorly, so they changed the ending. So it's not even the ending in the movie anymore.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that all your work was for naught, basically, in that volcano. But I'm happy, you know. Can you tell me any funny stories about Cougar Club when you guys were on set? Was there any hilarious moments?
It was so fun making the movie. I love doing comedies because you just laugh all day. It's so great to make a living just laughing all day. There's lots of stories. I think probably one of the funniest or like the weirdest moments for me as the director was when Warren Cole and I had to go into Faye Dunaway's dressing room to discuss the sexual position that they were going to be in the treehouse, you know, when the wall falls down and the whole party exposes them to the whole party. And so Warren and I actually got on the floor. I played her and he played me, and we to show her the position that the sexual position we wanted her to be in for camera that looked best on camera. So that was pretty funny. She made her laugh too.
Well, that's probably a dream come true for most guys anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
those guys, the Warren Cole and Jason German and Jeremy Rowley, were so great to work with. They could be big stars because they are just, I know it's a little movie, but they were so professional and it's funny. I when I delivered the movie to the studio that distributed it, we had to do all the DVD extras, and of course they always want a gag reel for the DVD, and I had a real hard time putting a gag reel together because they never messed up their lines, and they were always like literally never. I couldn't even barely cut together a gag reel of, you know, outtakes and stuff because they, you know, we were on a tight schedule, and they knew that, and they knew they would only get, you know, two or three takes, so literally they really never messed up. They were so great to work with, and they're so funny in the movie. I mean, Jeremy Rowley is just, he does physical comedy just really great.
So they don't, did they do very much improvising on the film at all?
Oh, yeah, we did. I like to work that way. I know it eats up a lot of time on low-budget movies, but it's really, it makes it so much more organic when, I mean, I was writing stuff with the actors right in between takes. Like, we would try stuff, and then I would say, hey, why don't you try this? And we came up with a lot of the gags that are in the movie just right then on the spur of the moment. And I think that's it works best when you let the actors try stuff and be free and you know, as a director and you know, do it as a collaboration, and you always get more out of it that way.
Okay, and going on to a couple of your other projects, you're producing actually a couple of documentaries coming out.
Yes.
IOUSA and John Henry.
Yes.
Do you want to kind of dive into documentary more, or do you think that you know the variety is nice?
Well, I think the variety is nice. These are the first documentaries that I've been involved with. I mean, I've always wanted to make them because I think it's such a great way to express truth in stuff that you may not get in mainstream media. And I think there's a lot of stories that could be told through the medium of documentary that wouldn't necessarily be told in a narrative film. And you really do. I've had a great time making both these movies, and I think it's such a great way to express, you know, a viewpoint of something. And I will totally, continue to make documentaries. I think it's a great format. I love it.
Okay. I think we have a call here, if I can get her on.
Okay.
608.
Hi, Mark. You know who this is. It's
Hi,
your
Rose.
Favorite cougar. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Do you have a question for Chris?
What kind of real life research did you do for that movie?
Well, I'm married, and so I had to live vicariously through some other people in the like Warren Cole and Jason German, who were the actors in the movie. But we did meet with a lot of older, you know, women actresses and people,
mm-hmm.
and I really enjoyed that.
Did you actually meet women who were involved with younger men? Or?
Oh, yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, cool, good,
some
you made it real then.
That, some famous actresses that came in to meet with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just to me, because they loved the idea and the concept, and there were cougars themselves. I won't name any names, but there's a lot of them
that are prominent. So.
Yeah. And by the way, my sister-in-law, Carrie Fisher, who's in the movie, she's a true-life cougar also.
Well, I'm not afraid to say that I prefer younger men, too. I'm 54, and I don't look it, and I don't act it. I date men in their 30s.
How old are you?
I'm 54.
Yeah. See, if I was an older woman, I would date younger men too. You know, the
it's
beauty.
It's about time society turns around. It's not just older men.
Right.
Who can
exactly.
Date
and
younger women. I mean, it goes the other way too. Hello.
Yeah. No, it's about time.
Yes. Yes. And there's. I don't know. I think I better just back off. I could give you some more details about older women.
Well, the interesting thing that I like about the whole notion of it all is that, you know, they say that guys sexually peak when they're, you know, 20, early 20s, and women sexually peak in their 40s. So it seems like a pretty good
thing. Guess again, dear. Guess again. There is another secret that's not being let out. It should get out. After women go through menopause, some of us get turned on.
Really?
Yes. You haven't heard of that? Go to hotmamas.com. That's where
hot
I went for my
com.
Research.
All
right. Hot mom, and it's not for hot as in sexual. It's hot as in hot flashes, okay? But, yeah.
All
right. You know, I did some research and I found out. Okay, I'm perfectly normal.
Well, what's great about it too is you know, a lot of older women like yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, are independent, and I don't know if, what your situation is, but you know, are independent and they're just looking for
very
a good time. And what's interesting is, you know, the young guys are just looking for a good time too. So there's no love lost there, you know.
Well, not only that, you can't make me pregnant.
That's true.
No trap here.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, guys,
no,
you know, young guys that are dating, you know, 22-year-old guys that are dating 22-year-old girls, they want, you know, they're nagging them all the time about this and that and say, you know, all that and want a commitment and everything. And most young guys don't want a commitment. They want to just have sex.
Okay,
so it's
yeah,
a great...
I'm not, yeah, I'm more refined. I do prefer friendships. I'm not, you know, quite that. But
well,
anyway,
but you know what I mean.
I do,
you don't, there's not like a big relationship has to happen.
No, I've got things that I want to do. I've more or less started a new career at 54, doing some wonderful, you know, things that Mark is helping me with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to get wrapped up because I don't know where in the country I'm going to end up. So I just want good friends.
Well, just have a good time.
Well, you know what? It's nice to know that that society is waking up and realizing that women are human too.
Yeah,
hello.
It is nice to know.
You know,
okay,
go ahead, Mark.
Okay, I was going to say that we had, I got a guest coming up in a few minutes, so I need to wrap up with Chris, but thanks for the call, Rose.
Okay, you're welcome. Nice meeting you.
No,
I haven't seen
the movie.
I've been on it. Okay.
Have
you
seen the movie yet?
No.
Oh.
I just found out about it. Mark, you'll have to send me the info on it so I can get it.
There's a website too, CougarClubTheMovie.com. You can see clips of the movie. You can actually see clips on YouTube also.
Okay.
And there's a MySpace page also. And you can get it on Netflix, Blockbuster. You can get it at Walmart.
Okay.
You know, all the usual places.
All right. Well, if you're on MySpace, I'm White Rose there. Look for a request.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, thanks, Rose. Chris. And then I've got a link on from Amazon on my front page as well. So,
great.
So if there's
great.
People that want to go and check it out, you can check it out.
Yeah.
And what was that? What was that site that originally that you got inspired? Was it Earth?
UrbanCougar.com. Yeah.
UrbanCougar.com. Where in Scottsdale were you at exactly? We have a young cougar, a very very beautiful cougar that actually is in Scottsdale area. Yeah.
You know, I've only been there one time, so I'm not sure what the area is called. But most of our investors on that movie are from that area, Scottsdale, Phoenix area. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And like I said, you can catch the movie on Netflix.
Amazon, Walmart, Best Buy, Blockbuster. You can rent it at Blockbuster or Netflix. You can watch it streaming live on Netflix. You don't even have to get the DVD. You can watch it on your computer. But you have to be PC based. It doesn't. If you're Mac, you can't do it. But it's doing really well out there. Like people are really responding to how good it is.
Excellent. Well, thanks for being on the show, Chris.
Absolutely.
We'll definitely
thanks
check
for
out your
me.
Movie again, and please keep us informed on those other movies that you're doing.
Well, I have a movie that we produced coming out next month called The Wizard of Gore. And it's being distributed through the Weinstein Company. Look for it. It's a really creepy, scary, psychological thriller with Crispin Glover and Bijou Phillips and Kip Pardue and a bunch of other, you know, horror cast people. And it's a really good movie. So it'll be on the shelves August 19th. It comes out.
So, yeah, and that's a remake. That's a remake of a film back in the 70s. They actually mentioned it in the film Juno.
Yeah, it exactly. It was the original movie was made by Herschel Gordon Lewis back in 1970, and we updated it and made a really cool remake of it. And it comes out August 19th, The Wizard of Gore. Check that out too.
Okay, then. Well, we'll definitely check that out as well.
We'll come back on the show when that comes out too, if you'd like, and talk about that more.
Oh, definitely. I'll keep in touch with you, and
okay.
I'll definitely try to book another interview, and we'll talk a little bit about Wizard of Gore.
All right, cool.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris.
All right, thank you.
That was Chris Duddy, everybody, an absolute great filmmaker. Cuckoo Clubs, I think, is still available on Netflix. You guys can check out, I'm pretty sure the website's still up as well. If you want to take a look at that movie, just find the regular outlets, and you'll be able to find that as well. Wizard of Gore, of course, is already out because it was that interview was back in 2008. So great to be able to see that as well. So make sure you guys check that out as well. I think I saw her momentarily call in our next guest, and I believe she is here. Very, very exciting rocker. She has a new album out called Beautiful Sin, and her new single right now is called Hot Blooded. She's a 17-year-old, and it's great to be able to see that we get a gal that is really into the rock scene. You gotta see her video for Hot Blooded, and listen to the music. It's absolutely great. The tracks are produced by herself and Megadeth group member Glenn Drover. You guys can check that out as well. I'm very privileged to have, if we can make sure I get it on there, Sophia Rafter. Try to get her on, and then we lost her. It's like the transporter malfunction. Sophia should be on, hopefully momentarily. I know she's trying to call in. It's great to be able to see that that we have such a whirlwind of talent to be able to a part of this. So hopefully, momentarily, she'll be on. Give me a second. I'm going to try to reset my board here and see if that'll help. Saw that she was calling in, but we lost her. It might be that cell phone service might be out where she is or whatever. So I'll give her a couple minutes to call in, because I saw her on the board and then tried to pick her up and then she vanished on me again. So hopefully she'll be able to call in momentarily. Okay, let's try it now. Sophia, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Are you there?
Hi, I'm here. Are you there?
Finally. Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, good. Great. Sorry. I had a problem with connecting, and I was like kind of like panicking, but anyways.
It's great.
Hello?
It's great to go beyond. Yeah. You hear me okay, right?
Yeah, now I do.
Okay. Well, first of all, how are things with you? I mean, it seems like the album's going over very, very well, and I was able to listen to Beautiful Sin, which is an absolute great track. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been going on so far in terms of this album?
Well, thank you for asking, and thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say that it's going really well, and I've been getting a lot of reviews on it, and I've been getting a lot of interviews out of it, and so it's been really awesome, and I'm actually happy with the way it's going, and everyone seems to be, responding to it well, and I'm just really honored with all the support I've been getting. So, yeah, everything's been great.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into music. I mean, was this something that you kind of grew up on? And, tell us a little bit about your backstory in terms of getting into music.
Okay. I was always involved in music in some way. Like, I grew up on the stage from very young. As a toddler, I was, dancing on stage and doing that kind of stuff. And I grew up in listening to gospel music and involved with choirs and things like that and musical theater. And somehow it kind of just evolved into something a bit greater than that. So what happened was I was 13 years old and I was taking an acting for the camera class in my hometown, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And I guess the teacher, the coach, asked us to do a self-portrait exercise, which is an exercise used to express yourself artistically in front of the classroom. So what happened was the coach basically told us to do that, so I did, and I prepared my first song. I picked up the guitar that was in the studio, and I wrote my first song then and there, and that was what I had to offer and perform in front of the class. And then the coach told me to never give up, so I never did, and here I am.
I mean, what were some of the music you were listening to back then. I mean, like I said, you have an edge to your music, and it's a refreshing edge to your music. But, you know, some of the people that you were listening to back in the day.
Well, okay, so back then I was, when I was about 13, I was really, I've always been into many genres of music. I've always been open to listening to many genres, so it can range from rock to reggae to metal to R&B, pop, even pop, things like that. So, and so I've always been kind of inspired by all of it, all of these genres, but in very unique ways. But what mainly drove me to start songwriting was this classic rock inspiration. So I have for classic rock. So I've been listening to from a very young age. I've been listening to people like AC/DC and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. I'm old school that way, and I'm proud. I'm glad that my parents had great taste in music to pass on to me. So that's how it happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting dynamic because I've had a lot of country singers on, and a lot of times they say, oh, yeah, I grew up on the old country music. And in contrast, you listen to a lot of the older rock and roll music, you know, that your parents listened to, which is, like I said, a surprising contrast. It goes to show a little bit more of the influences in terms of you growing up and what you're like, sometimes what your likes are and all that as well. And it's great to be able to see, you kind of, you know, hint into that and deep into that old rock and roll music. I mean, I don't know if you heard about, them being in an argument saying that the rock and roll is dead. True rock is dead. But, you know, hearing you, I think there's a light of hope that it's not dead anymore.
You're so sweet. Oh, thank you. Oh, wow. That's really awesome to hear. And I don't believe that rock and roll is dead. I believe that it will never die. You know, from generation to generation, it's going to evolve, and that's just how it is, how it's going to be, because new people, I believe that as long as people are around, rock will live on, because people will be inspired to pick up an instrument and inspired to songwrite. So as long as people are around, that true rock and roll vibe will be around because of the whole instrument guitar feel and all of that. And so, yeah, I do thank you for that compliment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to hear the heavy electric guitar. I mean, I miss it. I know a lot of people miss it. You know, being able to hear that on the radio. You know, we can listen to like some of the older folks or whatever. But it seems to be very circular in terms of how things go. Because I mean, right before Nirvana came out, it was like it. You know, we were getting a little bit more into the pop stuff, and then suddenly we heard this sound, and I think that, you know, we get that kind of circle around, and, you know, we're more than due to have that next cycle, you know, that one breakthrough will change it.
Yeah, I feel that too. I feel that I've heard just by like listening to people and what they think, they just feel like, I hear comments like this every day. Oh, I wish there was more real in music. I want that to come back. People do say it. I do hear people say, oh, let's go back to the real stuff. I do hear that. Like, I want real and raw and, you know, true. So, yeah, I do believe that.
Now, have you had the opportunity to perform very much from the tracks that you've had? And, I mean, obviously you're a really, really talented actress by all accounts. But just to perform on a stage and to be able to perform these songs, I mean, have you had the opportunity to? And what's the experience like to be able to rock out on stage?
Thank you. Well, I've had, since the age of 13, I've been performing my original music in Canada and in the UK. I actually haven't gone to the States yet, but I will be in 2016, and I'm so excited. I really am. Oh, my gosh. The States is where I need to perform. I need to go there. It's a goal of mine, and it's going to come true. I also have a tour booked in March for Vancouver. I'll be touring and playing stuff for my first album and my second album in Vancouver, and that's going to be really awesome. I can't wait for that, and it's going to be so awesome. So I do have opportunities that lie in America, and I just can't wait to get there. And I feel that as an actress, because I'm also an actress, and I've done, I was a lead in a film when I was 13 years old called 13 Downs. I feel that as an actress, it's very different from performing on stage. Like, it's a different kind of reel. Because when I'm on stage, I like being myself. I don't really like putting on a front, putting on, like, some kind of image. It's just me, and that is being happy and just being in the moment and loving what I do and getting a certain vibe from the crowd. I think that you can't replicate. You can't. You just can't. It's just a feeling that is just so unique and special. Just connecting with the crowd, it's amazing. So it's not the same as you know, acting in on stage for a crowd, like being musical theater or acting in a movie. It's not the same. There's different feelings involved, and I do love film, though. I really do. I have a passion for that. I love talking. Sorry, go on.
But yeah, and that brings me to a question that I like to ask a lot of musicians that come on the show. Now, sometimes you're on a small stage, sometimes you're on a big stage. Do you have a preference in terms of, you know, what one you perform on? The small stage, obviously, you're a little bit more intimate with your crowd, but then again, having a big stage is a way you have the ability to move around and to be able to react and really kind of, get things going in terms of that. Do you have a preference either or?
That's a good question. I don't have a preference for much, really, because I don't exactly like to say I prefer something to another thing, just because everything is, it's unique. It's a unique feeling you get. So from a very, intimacy, you can only get that from a small venue, in a pub or we're in a circle of people. Like, it's just a very intimate thing that you can't get when you're performing to a bigger crowd. But then the rush you get from the bigger crowd is so unbelievable that it's nothing like the intimacy that you get from a small venue. So there's no preference for me. I just love it all around. I just love it all around, definitely.
Now, if you could, and this is going to be an interesting question for you, if you could open up for any rock band of any era, even if they're broken up and they get back together for some odd reason, or they're dead and they come back alive or whatever, who would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. Wow, I've never gotten that question before, and that's a good one. Oh, wow. I like you. Okay. Let's see. I don't know. It'd have to be probably, could it be something like a band that's still going as well? Any band?
Yeah, it can be, yeah. Any band. Huh. Any band.
Any band. I would probably love, that's a really interesting question. Probably something like Guns N' Roses probably Guns N' Roses, definitely, because I think that my top hat kind of look goes well with Slash, because Slash is definitely, he's the top hat king. Like, he's the one, he's the king of top hats, of that look. So definitely, and to perform with him would be amazing. I would definitely love that. And I heard that there's talk that they're going to be reuniting, kind of. They're going to have a reunion.
Yeah, Coachella. And I was about to say that we need to campaign for you to go on to Coachella, to be able to be there at Coachella when maybe they'll open for him, and then maybe you can do a duet with Axl. I don't know. We'll see.
That'd be amazing. Wow. That'd be amazing. Yeah. I'd love that. Wow. It's wild to dream. But, yeah, definitely. So,
definitely
Guns N' Roses.
Wilder things have happened. So, I mean, there was one time, I think, where the Foo Fighters, where there was a guy that wanted to drum for him or something like that, and they brought him up to drum, I think.
You're kidding.
There are crazy stories. Yeah, there are these crazy stories.
That's great.
I mean, it's great to be able to see that as well. What kind of instrument, do you play any instruments at all?
Yeah, I'm a guitarist, and I've actually written, like, one of my first ever songs. I have 150 songs now. But one of my first ever songs was written on the piano. So I do kind of doodle on the keyboard and piano a bit, but I would consider myself a guitarist. That's like my main instrument. That's the instrument that made me fall in love with songwriting.
Okay, here's the question, because I've asked this of many a female musician, and so far none have actually answered it. Do you have a name for your guitar?
Yes, I do.
Wow,
okay.
you're the only person that has ever heard a guitar.
Oh wow, yeah, I do kind of. I don't talk to it or anything. Like, I'm not weird. It's just something.
No,
it's kind of. Yeah, I kind of just thought of it like the first time I saw it. So my Gibson, I just call them Gibby, and my Hudson, my Hudson Kingfisher. They're both from the UK. They're both UK. Like, I got them from a UK store. And my Hudson Kingfisher acoustic, I've named Saul Hudson, Mr. Saul Hudson, or King Saul Hudson, or something like that, because that's Slash's real name. And it's a Hudson brand. It's Hudson Co. So it just makes sense, since Slash's real name is Saul Hudson, to call him Saul Hudson. So I did. Yeah.
That's awesome, because, I have a lot of female performers that have come on the show, and none of them has said they've named their instrument. A lot of guys name their instruments. Even if they're country or rock, they'll still name the instrument that the girls never do.
That's really interesting.
Wow, you guys know. So, yeah, it's interesting that none of them do. Yeah, it's crazy. But, I mean, it's great to be able to see this kind of go and all that as well. You said you have 150 songs. Now, with that being said, I mean, are those produced songs, or are those songs that you've had written down in books, or?
Well, they're all copywritten, so they are technically songs, but I don't have all 150 released, no, not publicly, but they are copywritten. If I ever wanted to release them or work on them or do something with them, and they are full songs, which is good. But yeah, I just write, and sometimes I just write not even to want to release it. I mean, I always have that thought in mind. Okay, well, this I want to write, because I write for people. I like writing for my supporters and for anyone and everyone. So I always have that in mind, but sometimes it just doesn't work out that way, and I just don't release it, just because there might be another one that I prefer at that time that would be in good replacement if I have, like, a certain limit of songs I can produce at that time, just because of, time and energy and all that. But, yeah.
Okay, that brings me to two questions. The first one is the fact that you have a bunch of stuff that you have written down, right? Do you ever, find you put your stuff down, maybe there's might have stuff that you've maybe written when you're 13, 14, 15, that you've written down in notebooks. Do you ever go back to some of those things and then realize that you have an idea for it, and then you kind of bring it back to life and want to write
a song?
That's
a good question.
Or,
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that's how a lot of people work, is that they have something written from years ago, and then they might work on it, they might discover it and work on it and release it 20 years later. But since I've only been writing for three or four years now, I haven't actually gotten to that point yet where it, because when I first started songwriting, I definitely think that, I definitely know that I've matured as a songwriter and I've gotten stronger each and every day at working on it because I'm a prolific songwriter. So it just doesn't really make any sense to go back at this point, but doesn't mean that I won't ever go back. Right, but I've been writing so much that there's just no need to.
But you think obviously you'll eventually maybe in about another 5-10 years maybe go back and take a look at some
of
this stuff because you've heard obviously have you heard the Bruce Springsteen story about that?
The what?
Have you ever heard the story about Bruce Springsteen? Bruce had a very similar situation where he had written a song down and he had kept it in a drawer for like a decade. And he came back to it and then he ended up writing the rest of it
and
ended up being in. Yeah, it became a hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's why I like asking question because
I'm not at that level yet, or I hope to be at that level one day, but I'm not at that level yet, but I'm sure that if I ever get to that point, which I'm hoping I am because I'm a dreamer and I'm ambitious and everything, I would definitely go back and that would probably happen.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's great to be able to do that. A lot of comedians do the same thing too, actually. They'll write down jokes. And then they'll keep them in a notebook, and then maybe they'll go back and see if there's something that they can use in terms of their set or go some of the old sets and all that as well, too.
Yeah, and it's a good way to figure out if it's good because you go back and you don't say, oh, it's crap, I'm not going to use that. But you actually go back to something that you thought of a while ago and think, wow, that's actually a really good idea. So if you still think that at this time in the present moment, then it must be a good idea.
Or it could just be a simple thing of timing. You know, you're at a point in your life where you have an experience or you have something and you remember something way back when, you know, you were going for a similar instance or there was an idea that you had that was like, well, now it makes a lot more sense now. So we get that kind of feeling too. I get that as well. The other question off of that, off the comment you made was, obviously, creative types never, really, sit down and sometimes and just come up with ideas. Sometimes they're on planes. Or I've had a friend of mine, Aaron O'Brien, who's another really great rock and roll singer, talk about writing ideas on airplane barf bags,
napkins,
on the plane. So I mean, obviously now I hear a lot of times with iPhones and having phones now, you have the idea to be able to record ideas and all that as well. I'm assuming you do the same thing.
Of course, I love the old school way with the pen and paper and that whole thing. So when I get the chance, I do scribble things down now and then. But now I have a tablet, so it's just easier and more logical to just put everything in one place so that it's not all messy and stuff, right? And sometimes it's a better idea because your tablet is locked and safe and whatever. So it's less chance that someone's going to pick up your napkin or your paper and see your notes and steal it, right? And steal your ideas. But then technology, if it breaks and everything's in there and you can't get it back. So it's good to have backup. So, I guess I do both. I do both.
Well, I mean, obviously, if it's in the cloud, you're able to save it. But I was going to mention the Green Day story. I don't know if you're familiar with the Green Day story, but
I'm familiar with Green Day, but I don't know about the story.
Do you know the story about how American Idiot came about?
No, I don't know that story.
Okay, they had another album in mind before American Idiot, and they had a notebook that had the songs on it. Well, they lost the notebook. On tour, and they asked, they were like, they had lost the notebook. There was an reward for it and all that as well. But they went on to make American Idiot. And I kind of found that a very interesting story because, if they would have done that other album, they wouldn't have done such a great stellar album like American Idiot. So I think it was almost a blessing in disguise.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's oh my gosh, it's fate, you know, it's just how things work. I do believe that everything happens for a reason. That's what I believe, and that's kind of like the motto I live by, or try to at least. I do believe that everything happens for a reason. So there's a reason for everything. And if, you know, if something happens that drastic and tragic, then there's obviously something that's going to come of it that's even better, you know. So, yeah, I believe that.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to be able to be able to see that, you know, happen as well. I want to talk a little bit more about the album, though. I mean, the reason of, you know, besides the fact that you're a really talented singer, a guitar player, and like I said, you have a really good edge in terms of your sound, is not only yourself, but the people that produced the album and some of the people that you worked with on this album. Can you tell us a little bit about these people that you were able to work with, how you got involved with Glenn and the guys, and the guys, and just, I mean, how did that come about?
Okay, well, I started out taking guitar lessons from Glenn, and then we kind of just, you know, he knew I was a songwriter, and obviously that's my thing, so he said, well, how about I do some lead on your songs, and we'll see what happens there. So I said, oh, great, that sounds great. So he worked on some lead stuff on my first album. He was a session lead guitarist on my first album, and then I decided that I wanted that it'd be good for me if he could produce my second album. So I'm co-producing. I co-produced that second album with him, Beautiful Sin, my most recent one. And I think he's just a really great guy, and I love working with the Drover brothers. I think they're really inspiring, and especially with all their knowledge, and they're very worldly guys. So obviously I had an awesome, wicked experience with them, and especially Ronnie Dog Robson on bass. He's my bass player for the album. So it was awesome. Just working with them was just so humbling, a humbling experience, inspiring, and all those awesome words. So yeah.
Going through the process of producing your first album and then going into the second one, have you learned a lot in terms of the production and what you kind of have to know in terms of producing an album,
mm-hmm.
and producing a track? What were some of the things that you've learned?
Yeah, I've learned a lot. I definitely, before the album I produced, I had some singles produced and released, but it wasn't as intense as recording and working on an album, that's for sure. Like, I had a lot of I wouldn't say stressful times, but, you know, it is work, right? So work comes with stress. That's just a fact. That's a given. So definitely I had some moments, some kind of like epiphanies where I just didn't have with the second album. The second album, the process with that was way smoother and way easier because I knew what I was getting into, and I knew and I understood all the technical terms used and how the tracking works and all of that. So I definitely had a smoother time working on the second album, definitely. Both experiences were great, and without the first, I wouldn't be at the second. I wouldn't have the second album. So I always have to keep that in mind. It's all about steps. It's all about steps, stepping stones, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, a lot of people are really learning on the fly in terms of what they do in the studio, and you're lucky enough to have somebody that has been in the studio before and knows what to listen for, you know, give good enough tips or whatever to be able to give you that kind of input. Which is great.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. So okay. Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm here. I thought you were going to say something else, but.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm honored. Well, I can say something else. I can say that, yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you there. But those two experiences were definitely different from one another.
Well, going off of that, I mean, you have a video, out for Beautiful Sin. Was this your first video, or did you do a, another one before your first album?
Music video?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for my first album, I had a music video I shot in London, England, which was a really cool experience. And that was for my song Heat Wave, my single Heat Wave, off of my first album, Intoxicated. And that was awesome. And but I also did this new video, Hot Blooded, for my second album. Hot Blooded, the single off of Beautiful Sin. And those experiences were really awesome, and both songs have totally different vibes, so definitely being on set of both were different experiences altogether, even though it is film and it's the same kind of thing, but the mood, the set of the set was different. It was just different. It was the moodiness of Heat Wave and the more innocent and uplifting and happy experience of Hot Blooded. So both experiences were very unique, and I cherish that definitely. And actually Hot Blooded was with the music video was filmed in Ottawa, my hometown, which was really awesome because I knew that eventually I'd have to do that. So, and I worked with an awesome guy that I've worked with worked on film sets before. His name's Derek Price, with Say 10 Productions, and it was just an awesome experience, and it was just amazing. So, yeah, thanks for asking.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about, you know, well, first of all, the experience for, with the Heat Wave video, obviously, it's your first one, you being shot. You have experience acting, but just to be able to do that first video, what was your feelings? And, I mean, were you a little bit nervous? And with both of these videos, did you have any input in terms of what was being shot or the concept of what each one were?
Yeah, Heat Wave, the one I shot in London, England, I'm never nervous. I never get those nervous feelings before I get on set or when I'm on set. I never have those feelings. I guess I was just more nervous about probably entering London, England, and the big city, and it was just really eye-opening to me. It was an eye-opener, definitely. So just being in a different country was pretty thrilling, but also came with nerves, I guess. But it was fun, and I just went with the flow. I love living in the moment, so nothing really bothered me. I was just myself, and I kind of didn't put any acting on for music videos. I don't tend to, because the emotion just comes out naturally without even trying, because it's the mood of the song that I'm singing. So it just, the moodiness of Heat Wave just came out perfectly and just naturally. Everything's just so natural, but also has that kind of amazing wow factor when you watch it. It's really cool. And but definitely, I feel that Heat Wave actually had a more, even though I was younger, I feel like I was more innocent and happy in Hot Blooded. And I'm older, so it's kind of interesting. I think it just had something to do with being in the moment and real and just feeling the song the way it's meant to be felt.
And then, did you have any input in terms of the concept, in terms of either one of these music videos?
Oh, of course, of course. I like being in control of my music and everything to do with the industry. I like being in control because, you know, I just like being me. And if I can't be me, then what's the point of even, you know, sharing my music with the world? So I am in control of that. Obviously, I love working and collaborating with people. So I had a great time collaborating with the director of these music videos. So we just collaborated. So I have some ideas, and then they kind of just make it happen and make it real and suggest ideas to me. And then I'm either like, oh, yeah, that's great. I'm open to that. That's awesome. Or, no, I've decided on this, kind of. But in the end, I have control of what's released and everything. But, yeah, I did have input, obviously, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's great to be able to hear that as well. I mean, you know, kind of going off of that, do you, I mean, obviously you're a very creative person, all that as well, and you're an actor, obviously. I mean, have you considered, is it something that you're thinking about down the line, maybe making your own movie?
Oh, I've thought of that, of course, but that's a totally different process, like being behind the camera than in front of it. And I love being in front of it just because it comes naturally. But I definitely have thought of directing films before or shooting them. I have an interest in that as well. But right now I'm mainly focused on just getting my music out there and for everyone to listen to that and see that kind of side of me before any of that comes out. But definitely, I mean, I have my whole life ahead of me, so, and I'm really excited because I know that I'm going to want to explore different routes and explore the film route, and I definitely want to get back into film after my experiences with the film and being a lead in a feature film. I definitely miss it, because I've had to put that on hold right now just because I'm so busy with my music and I'm just perfecting one before I go into the other again. But I, in the very near future, I will be back in film, and I can't wait.
Donnie, yeah, quite a few filmmakers I've had on the show are based out of Toronto. So, I mean, that area is becoming, you know, is between that and Vancouver, or basically the Hollywood and New York, basically, of filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
Up in Canada.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the places
in Canada.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll leave you this one last question, and we'll start to wrap up. The scene, I mean, I've heard so many great things about the Toronto scene in terms of music as well, and, you know, your Ottawa's roughly a hop, skip, and a jump. I mean, it's got to be a little bit of ways, but still in the eastern portion of Canada to be able to play there as well. What's the scene like in your area, and kind of have you been over to Toronto and checked out their scene?
Yeah. Well, it's about 5 hours away, like if you're going to drive there by car. 5 hours away, Toronto is. But I'm never in one place, and I'm never, like, just in one place. I'm always on the road with my mother. I'm always on the road, so it doesn't really feel like I have a home base anymore because I've traveled so much. So it doesn't, I have a home, obviously, but I just don't feel like I have a home base because it's just, you know, it's nice to have something to come back to, but I prefer being that gypsy. Like, I prefer being on the road. And obviously, I do have the option of coming back, but I love traveling the world. It's something that I love. So I don't really know much about, I mean, I know that it's starting, the Ottawa area for film and music is starting to become more and more known, but obviously it's not as known as the Toronto area. So I did, like, when I do go to the Toronto area very much, and that's where I have gigged mostly in Canada, is in the Ontario region. So definitely, but I like seeing hope. I love seeing hope. I do think it's hopeful that the Ottawa area will expand for the music industry and the film, just because there's just so many talented people here, and there's just so many talented people everywhere, you know? So I want everyone to be known. I just kind of like that. That's me. But thank you for asking that.
Yeah, you know, I really... You know, I think that, you know, Canada's been doing really, really kick-ass in terms of their music scene. And, you know, I sometimes think it gets overlooked a little bit towards the American side of things. But
It does.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, I think that there's a lot of talented individuals that are really starting to make waves up there, especially yourself.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see how everything kind of goes. And it's great to be able to see that you're going to be touring down here in the United States at some point. It'd
oh,
be
yeah.
Lovely,
I can't wait.
Yeah,
yeah,
it'd be great
totally
for you to
can't wait.
Some point to. Yeah, I really hope that you make it to Vegas at least. You know, I mean, there's a really good rock scene here actually, and it's really dying out. So
I know. I'm definitely planning on it. Don't worry, I'll be there. Definitely.
Well, yeah, and I want to mention. I mean, if you want to see where Sophie is going, please go to her website. And it's Radish. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
you actually are. Congratulations. A lot of people say radish, or but people like are really surprised when I say, no, it's radish, like the vegetable. But good thing it's not spelled the same way.
Yeah, SophiaRadish.com. You guys can check her out there and where she's going to be at and all that as well. She's on Facebook, of course, and Twitter under the same handles as well. Like I said, I really look forward to listening to more of your stuff that comes out, because, like I said, we've been lacking a really hard edge in terms of music, and I think you're one of those little lights that we're seeing at the end of the tunnel, where we're going to start seeing that a lot more often in the next couple of years. So.
Well, thank you. Well, I plan on keeping at it and just loving what I do and working hard and not stopping. That's the goal, is to just not stop.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to talk to you a little bit more down the line. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure to have talked to you, and we'll hopefully, maybe when the next single comes out, or, maybe when the next album comes out, we'll get you back on the show.
Or maybe sooner than that. Maybe sooner than that, please. Definitely.
Oh,
we'll always have
you're
to
welcome
talk
anytime,
about,
Sophia. We
thank
can co-host
you.
One of these days too.
Oh yeah, that'd be cool. Maybe that'd be great.
Yeah,
one
if you ever,
day, yeah.
ever want to co-host on the show, feel free to do so. We'll have to keep in touch, and you can always co-host with me one of these episodes.
Oh, cool! I sure would love that. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, no problem at all, Sophia. Best of luck to you. I really look forward to seeing how your career progresses, and keep on rocking.
Thank you. You keep on rocking.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon, Sophia.
Bye.
Bye. Sophia Radish, everybody. SophiaRadish.com. Absolutely lovely girl. Really, really hard rocker. If you haven't heard her single, Beautiful Sin, please look it up on YouTube. You guys can check it out as well. I should also mention you can buy the album. Let me see here. If you go to this SophiaRadish.com, I believe there's a link there, but she sent me a link, and I should probably do it as well. *1ENT.com. That's *1ENT.com /Sophia-Radish. You'll be able to find her album there. Be able to do that as well. I wish that it was on Amazon, and Amazon should have it, but they don't have it on there yet. iTunes and Amazon do have some of her music. I guess they did this that the tracks are off or something like that. But definitely go to SophiaRadish.com. You'll be able to download her albums or whatever. Definitely check out the Beautiful Sin video, and you'll see what I'm talking about in terms of her really just rocking out a lot about that hardcore guitar that we've been missing in music for the past 5-6 years or even more than that. May definitely check her out as well. With that in mind, I think I'll be back next week. I am working on getting another filmmaker in here before Slam Dance comes around. Slam Dance and Sundance come around. There'll be one more person that hopefully we'll be on here as well. We'll get another musician on as well. I think I'm going to stick with that theme for a little bit. Maybe a filmmaker before, and then a throwback interview, and then a musician after it. I like that kind of text. It feels so good to be able to do it. And we'll start screwing Wednesdays. For the time being, I need to update VegasPodcasting.com and update when we're going to be doing the shows, because we'll be doing them Wednesdays now from now on. Definitely check us out next Wednesday. I think we should have a show. Please follow us on Twitter at SWIV, at SWIV, and Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook. And we'll have an announcement about when our next thing is. So at SWIV, that stands for Somewhere in Vegas. You guys can check that on Twitter as well. And you'll be able to see when we'll have our next show, which should be next Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. With that in mind, we'll talk to you guys next week.